Today's program is brought to you by the Museum of Food and Drink, sparking curiosity about food with exhibits you can eat. For more information, visit mofad.org.
Thank you for listening to Heritage Radio Network. We are a member-supported, nonprofit food radio station. That means that every single thing we do, from broadcasting 35 weekly shows for free, to bringing you exclusive content from sold-out food events across the country, to offering scholarships to high school students, is only possible thanks to the support of our loyal members. And we want you to join the club. Become a member during our 2017 summer drive to get access to sweet swag and pledge your support to the world's only food radio station. Visit heritageradionetwork.org/donate to become a member now.
Hello, hello. You are listening to Food Without Borders on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sari Kamen. I have two guests on the show with me today, which is very nice. First, I have Deepti Sharma. She is the founder of Food to Eat, a service where companies can order meals from the best local restaurants, food trucks, and caterers, many of which are immigrant-owned businesses. She's a Forbes 30 Under 30 alumni, and she serves on the board for the Business Center for New Americans, a nonprofit that encourages immigrant entrepreneurship by providing microloans and financial education. I also have Karina Swad. She is the co-founder of Semsem, a modern Lebanese eatery that she runs with her sister Christine, inspired by the flavors of her native Beirut. Hello, ladies.
Hi.
Deepti, Karine, so nice to have you both here.
Nice to be here.
So you run Food to Eat, Deepti, and Semsem is one of your vendors.
Absolutely.
So that's why you're both here in the room together.
Yes.
Listeners out there. So Deepti, why don't we start with you, and why don't you explain what Food to Eat is?
Yeah, so Food to Eat is a corporate catering concierge service where we partner with local food vendors, a lot of which are immigrant women and minority-owned businesses. We do work with every vendor that we like, you know, that we love their food of, but we like concentrating on immigrant women and minority-owned businesses. One, because it's who I am, and you know, I'm a woman, I'm a woman of color. And first generation of, you know, my parents moved here back in the 70s. So I love representing who I am. And so what we do is we essentially become their sales and marketing and provide their catering services to corporates, getting corporates to eat more locally, and being more conscious of what food they're serving in their offices when it comes to client meetings or team lunches. And the idea is for corporations, we essentially become their one-stop shop for food and beverage in all capacities. And we like to do that by empowering the amazing stories of New York City food vendors that are surrounding them. But a lot of times they don't get a chance to try or test out because they're too afraid to. So we, you know, we tell them we do all the vetting for you. We make sure that these vendors are going to be on point and going to be able to succeed in whichever capacity they need them to. Yeah, and so that's what we do.
So you're almost like a third party.
We are a third party, but we like to see ourselves as partners to the restaurants. Uh-huh. A lot of times restaurants don't come from backgrounds of MBAs or business degrees, and you know, they're mom and pops. And so what they do best is making their amazing food. And so we want to come in and help them do the other side. Semsem is not one of those that doesn't come from like a business background, but is a vendor that we love, especially because of their story and their background and how they've decided to bring Lebanese food to America. And again, it's also for us, it's not just whether they're capable of doing it on their own or not, but we want to empower the stories that they come with. You know, food is more fun and interesting when there's a story behind it. And that's what we want to do, is bring out the stories, not just, you know, throw food on a table. We want to say, where does it come from? Where do these ingredients come from? Where do the recipes come from? And that's what we find most interesting.
Yeah. So how do you do that? How do you not only present the food, but you also
you create a context for the story.
So for an example, when we first onboarded Samsung, what we did is we had them come into our office. We do a tasting. So first, we want to make sure that we love their food. We sit down with the owner. We do an interview with them. And the interview isn't like a formal interview where we sit down and ask them like 10 questions that are the same every time. It's just us trying to get an understanding and feel for who they are. Why did they start their business? I think that's more important than to me what they do. I always say to every entrepreneur I talk to, what is the why of your business? And that's what makes me want to work with them even more. So part of our process is to get to know them, get to understand their food, why they started their business. And as we talk to, you know, as because we're essentially a concierge service, we talk to our companies, and as we're going through the process of understanding what it is that they want in their office, what kind of food they're trying to bring in, we talk to them about these stories, and we talk to them about, for example, Samsung, or we talk about our other vendors that have these interesting stories and backgrounds, and we tell them, hey, you know, we have another vendor, Mama Gyra, who is a mother-daughter business, and their recipes came from Greece, and they came from their grandmother, and you see a spark in people's eyes. They're like, oh, that's really cool, because I'm, you know, now not just supporting this Greek vendor that's down the street, but I'm also supporting these two women that are running this business, and who doesn't want to see them grow and flourish, right? Mm-hmm. And it becomes more interesting when it's not just a big conglomerate like Chipotle.
Yeah.
Not to call them out or on anything, but just...
Fine, I'm sure they're used to it at this point.
Yeah, exactly.
So how do you find the businesses that you work with?
So when I first started the business, it was a lot of door-to-door. I'm just reaching out to businesses that at places that I like eating. And now we're at a point where we've done well by our vendors, and we get them from references or even our clients. You know, we tell and encourage our clients to tell us what food they want to see, and if there are vendors that they get to enjoy on the weekend. Because the idea is, you know, I think a lot of times when you're working at these larger corporations, you end up enjoying food within only a 2-block radius of where you work. Mm-hmm, and on the weekends, you get to enjoy everything that's outside of your comfort zone. And so what we say to them is that we want to bring that weekend smorgasbord experience that you go to Williamsburg for, or, you know, Queens to your office. So wherever you're eating on the weekends, let us know, and we're going to bring that experience in. And oftentimes, you know, their clients will say, you know, I don't even get to leave New York. Let us bring that local experience of New York City to you. And yeah. So a lot of times it's, where are we eating? Where are our clients eating? What can, you know, what kind of stories can we find from there and bring them to other clients?
Yeah. So how does it actually work?
So we have an online platform where clients can place their own orders, but our concierge is the more is the bigger part of our business. So we get to know account manage, we get to know office managers and HR managers. Their jobs are to run anything and everything in an office. They, you know, we sit down, get to know their, we create a taste profile is what we like to call it. Essentially dietary restrictions, you know, what cuisines are their team members more prone to liking and eating in the office. Based off of the questionnaire that we do, we put together, you know, a list of vendors that we know that they'll like, based off of whatever they're trying to, whether it's a team lunch or, you know, guests, clients that they're servicing, or entertaining. And based off of that, we, you know, present certain proposals that we think that would be a best fit for them. You know, usually we put like a 2-liner of the stories of the vendors.
So you actually recommend food to the businesses?
Yes.
Oh, interesting. That's
so our,
nice.
Yeah. So our clients are ad agencies, law firms. Okay. A lot of them are like...
it's like a dating service, but for food, kind of?
Almost. It's almost like that, yeah. We get to know both sides. We you know, we
and they're like, I think you would match with this food.
Actually, that's... Like, yeah. I've never thought of it that way, but yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
I've actually tried, like, concierge dating, so that's why it sounds so much like that.
How's that been?
Not very successful,
well,
unfortunately.
Well, I can say...
I think I'd do better if someone was presenting me food, I'd get more excited.
Yeah. Swipe right more often.
Yeah.
Food is just.
I'd be like
else.
Lebanese food. Swipe right. Yes.
That would be great. Well, maybe that's our next step. You know, creating an app where you can swipe left or right on what food you like. But
you heard it here first. You got that one for free.
Yeah. But yeah, I mean, the most important thing for us is, again, our vendors. When I first started the business, interestingly enough, we started off as a B2C business, and we were an online ordering platform for food trucks. And the reason I started that business was I was waiting online at a food truck. And I waited for 20 minutes, and I thought, why am I waiting for so long? There should be a better way for me to access this food truck. Instead of just starting the company as the Seamless for Food Trucks, as people like to explain it, I decided to talk to the vendors. And one of the biggest things that I noticed was that a lot of the vendors didn't see themselves as small businesses. They just saw themselves as, this is a job I do, I show up, I pay the bills. And food trucks, especially in New York City, are seasonal. So a lot of times the problem became, you know, they would have to pick up second jobs and, you know, stop their food truck. And so what we wanted to do was a way for them to sustain their business by being able to keep it all year round. And the way we did that is being able to provide them a predictable order. So people were able to pre-order the day before for the next day so they can kind of forecast what's going to happen tomorrow. What do I need to prepare for my regular lunch crowd that stands in line, but also these orders that people are coming to pre-order and pick up. And
so the food trucks that you work with like still operate as a food truck where people stand in line, but then they also have this other component now of their business that...
Yeah, I mean, so like I said, when we first started, it was this online ordering platform for food trucks. Think of it as a Seamless for food trucks. But the whole idea was, how do we empower these food trucks to grow their businesses? And we pivoted for a lot of reasons, which I don't want to get into. But the idea is, the mission for us and for me personally has always been, how to empower local food vendors to think of themselves as small business owners, to think of the, you know, ways to, you know, talk about themselves and encourage, you know, they didn't even name their food trucks. They all were halal cart or halal truck. Yeah. Yet every single one of them had a different kind of way of cooking, had a different kind of falafel, and they weren't marketing themselves. Mm-hmm. So that's where we took it into our hands. Okay, well, we're going to do your sales and marketing, and catering is a bigger business. Catering is more predictable. It's easier. It's a lot of, you know, their average ticket was $20 when we were doing the consumer business, just takeout orders. And when we started focusing on catering, it became, you know, $600. Mm-hmm. So you can see why that was a natural transition for us. We always wanted to add more value for them. Being able to outsource their catering to us is great for them.
Yeah.
It's a different type of skill set also. I think one thing that's very important to know, as restaurateurs, we're really good in operations. We're really good at making good food. But the outreach, the sales, is not something that all of us master that well. So having someone that can be a partner and go and knock on doors and explain even better than us sometimes what you actually do is invaluable. And this is why I think what Deepti is doing is working as well with food truck as it is with like more established restaurants, because it's a totally different set of skills.
Yeah. How did it affect your business, Kareen?
So it affected it in many ways. First of all, definitely it was interesting on a sales level because we were able to get to more clients. But also, I think when someone is trying to describe your business, it makes you really aware about some things about it that you want to tweak, refine, or even highlight. And we did a talk with Deepti 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, and the questions he asked, the way she presented the information that she has from her client, made us re-question a lot of things. And this is something that we really enjoy with the partners. And this is why I think Deepti, when she mentioned that it's not only, you know, a concierge service in the sense that she's reselling the product, but it's really a partnership, I think this is what she means, because they really have this interface with the client. They really have this exposure to so many requests and needs, etc., that it really affects the way we present ourselves.
Yeah. I mean, while we're here, why don't you tell us a little bit about your business?
So our business, Simsim, started in 2008. My sister was in a cab in Washington, D.C., and she was telling him that she was from Lebanon, and the guy had no clue where that was. And at the time, she was still is the franchisee of Dunkin' Donuts in Lebanon, and all she knew was food. So she thought to herself in that cab that she wanted to start something to talk about the food, the heritage, and the culture that we have. She went back to Lebanon, and together we toured villages. So we went to each village, we asked guests to send us recipe, and we did something we called the recipe hunt, to gather more than 1,500 recipes from our guests. And the initial thought behind that was that our generation doesn't cook as much, and all the recipes that are not either in a cookbook or in a restaurant are going to disappear.
So wait, so I think it's kind of interesting that you just said your sister essentially brought Dunkin' Donuts to Lebanon.
It was the first American franchise to open.
But then she's also working to like cultivate like an archive of traditional Lebanese recipes, because you both like lament the fact that your generation is no longer cooking traditional
exactly,
food.
Exactly.
Is there a conflict of interest there? Like,
on
is there
the
a tension
contrary,
there?
Okay. I think the beauty of it is to take the process and the skills you develop through a franchise and try to instill it in a restaurant. So just think about it. If you have traditional recipes, if you go and you look for this emotional recipe and add to it all the systems and processes that you can learn from a big franchise, you have a winning model because you're able to be true to your roots, but also do it in an efficient way. And this is what we tried to do, and this is how
That's
we grew.
Definitely one way to look at it.
Yeah,
I mean, hopefully Dunkin' Donuts isn't putting any like mom and pop restaurants out of business at the same time in Lebanon.
No, actually, in Lebanon,
do people like Dunkin' Donuts in Lebanon?
It's very different. The brand positioning there is very different. First of all, you have to imagine that she started 20 years ago. She was 23 years old at the time. Crazy.
That is really crazy.
Yeah, she. I don't even know how they gave her the franchise. I think they just thought that Lebanon was irrelevant at the time.
Like, might as well give it a shot.
She's literally the only one who applied for
and
it.
Yeah, I'm sure she was. She now has like 45 stores. It's the biggest concentration of Dunkin's per capita in the world.
Whoa. Are they all in Lebanon?
They're all in Lebanon. So yeah, and the way people look at it, especially my generation, we didn't have a hangout place. So we would like hang out in houses. We would go to our grandmothers or our mom. So Dunkin' was the first place for us to hang outside of home, to go to study. And the American dream is very much present still in the Middle East, despite what you might be hearing in the news. We have a lot of love and respect for that, for those ideals. So on the contrary, for us, it was a home away from home. And Tsum Tsum, in the sense, is still a home away from home for immigrants or for people like me who are outside their home country. So there are a lot of things
so
in
Tsum
common.
So Tsum Tsum is to the United States kind of what Dunkin' is to Lebanon? SAT speak?
That's simplifying it a bit. But
I'm sure.
But yes, in a way, we're trying to be, again, a home away from home, either in Lebanon for young people who can find a hangout place or here for people who are looking for this warmth and coziness that you are definitely missing in big cities.
That's interesting. The same thing actually happened in India as well, where it was this safe place where parents could trust their kids going to.
With Dunkin' Donuts, the same?
Yeah, well, it wasn't
with
Dunkin' Donuts. It was other franchises, you know, foreign franchises. And also kids loved it because there was air conditioning. And because the middle class kids growing up in India couldn't afford air conditioning, so it was a better
alternative. I would literally rather be in Dunkin' Donuts today than my apartment because of the weather outside. So I get that.
At least the air conditioning is working there, right?
Yeah. Anywhere with AC is fine with me. So did you grow up in Beirut?
I did. So I lived in Beirut until I was about 18. Then I moved to France, lived there for 10 years. And I was a strategy consultant at the time, working in finance and strategic planning. And I transferred. I was at the Boston Consulting Group, and I transferred with the BCG to New York. And one day my sister was visiting, and it's a story that might sound very similar to that of other people that you had on the show, like Manal, that's a very good friend. We were looking for a good hummus, and it was impossible for us to find a very good hummus. And
what year was this?
So that was before Manal.
I'm not questioning. I'm just curious because hummus feels so pervasive now. I'm just wondering.
It is everywhere, but yeah. Hummus is everywhere. Good hummus is not.
But good hummus is not. Okay.
A real hummus and
We've
our hummus.
You've been eating it all wrong.
You have, honestly. So good hummus or our hummus takes 12 hours to make because this is a product where you cannot have shortcuts. You have to boil it right, shell it right, freeze it, or chill it to the right temperature. And doing it right really has a very important impact on the end product. So this is how it all started for us. We were walking and we were trying to find this food done well and done the right way, and it was impossible for us to find it.
So you went on a hummus crawl.
We did. We actually tried 72 restaurants in a week.
Wow.
Oh my God, I'd be throwing up.
We were hummused out by the end of it.
Yeah.
That was painful, yes. Now, the end of it was really, really painful. The last 2 days, we were like, ah. But we couldn't find what we were looking for.
Didn't find it?
Nope. No.
So she had to create it.
Exactly. So that's how it started. A very painful 7 days of eating hummus.
Oh, man. I don't feel that bad for you. That doesn't sound like such a horrible experience.
You built a business out of it.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So that was the inspiration.
Yep.
So Tsemtsem was already existed at this point in Lebanon?
So Tsemtsem started in 2008 in Lebanon, and we started expanding in the Middle East. So we were in Saudi, Kuwait, Oman, Lebanon, and we are opening now in Dubai. And in 2015, we opened our first store here in the U.S.
And what was it like? What's the difference between how it exists in the Middle East versus how it exists in America?
So in the Middle East, it's a casual restaurant. So basically, you have full table service. It's bigger stores. You have a lot of like daily dishes, etc., that take a lot of time. Here, we transform the format into a fast casual. So it's mostly counter service. The portions are different, but the spices, the recipes are still the same. And I think that's, for me, and I was telling Dipti that last time, for me, that's the biggest reward. When you have your grandmother's recipe being sold in a street in New York, there's something invaluable about that, and there's something that makes you go back to work every day and be like, okay, I want to give it another shot, and I want to try even harder and stronger.
Is your actual grandmother's recipe part
yes.
of the menu?
So it's actually our best seller, yeah? Which created a family feud, because there's my mom's recipe, my grandmother's recipe, and my recipe. And literally, I get texts every day being, who won today? Who
in the family.
So we are a slightly competitive family. And the fact that the three main recipes are definitely things that we eat at home as...
What are those recipes?
So first of all, the hummus is my grandmother's recipe. It's the same...
And wasn't that also Manal's grandmother's hummus?
Yes,
that
yes.
She
yes. And we compared
yeah.
pictures and...
and you're going to have process. A hummus off.
Yeah, a blind test.
I will judge.
Okay, we're Lebanese. I'm going to have to bribe you some.
With hummus done.
So the hummus, the tawuk chicken, which is our best seller. It's sweet paprika, tomato sauce, and a bit of red wine vinegar. And the shawarma, the oven-baked shawarma, that's my mom's recipe.
Did you have to adapt any of the recipes for more American flavors, or are they just as traditional as they were in the Middle East?
We tried not to. Mm-hmm. So what we did was select the dishes that people would like. So I know that some dishes, we did a lot of focus group, and again, my former colleagues at the BCG tried everything. They were real sports. A lot of things we ended up removing from the menu, but the things that are on the menu are the exact same recipe that we have around the world. And that's important for us, because we consider that at least for Lebanese food, there's no real reference. So our role is to also educate people to try something different. It's not because it's a bit more tangy or a bit more, spicy or herbal than something you're used to that you're not going to like it. So our role is to really educate on what the flavor should be.
And that's really important, the authenticity of the food, right? A lot of these corporates that we work with, you know, they work with large food service conglomerates, and they'll have their version of Greek or Mediterranean or Mexican.
It's washed down. Exactly.
It's cheddar cheese on everything. Mm. Although when you ask a lot of, you know, like Mexican friends, they don't actually eat cheddar cheese. They, have a different kind of cheese and a different kind of consistency. And so that's what we try to do as well, is the educational process. And a lot of times, you know, if clients are willing, we have the vendors come in and do a little educational piece and talk about their food. It's that same awareness. I'm Indian. I grew up in New York, and I grew up taking my mother's home cooking to my elementary school. And I remember kids just making fun of me and saying, oh, that smells, it's gross, it's disgusting, and Indian people smell. And, you know, it was tough dealing with that. But instead of getting upset and sad, I was like, hey, do you want to try this? Because it's actually really good. Mm-hmm. And I would talk through what my mom, like, put in it. And I was like, oh, it's potatoes, and she put some spices and turmeric and all this. And kids would get excited because, you know, growing up, kids are afraid of what they don't know. I think that carries through throughout people's...
That's literally the point. Like, that was the inspiration for creating this show.
Yeah, and so that educational process, and I think that goes for everything we're going through today, is education around all the issues that we have, whether it's with gender or with immigration. It's let us talk to each other about what we're doing, how we're doing it. And so for me, it's so important to empower these awesome food vendors, and the fact that it's so important for them to do that, and that they've already been doing that, it makes our job even easier, because Samsung has built their brand around that authenticity, and what we're doing is only taking that and amplifying that even more.
Yeah.
And you notice how many commonalities there is. Like turmeric, for instance, that you're talking about, we call it kurkuma, but we use it all around. And again, we had a lot of Indian people come in and be like, oh, I know that. Or a lot of people from Korea were like, oh, this looks similar to something I ate. And you had the weirdest common points that you actually find in food. So that was a really nice experience. And even though people are sometimes afraid, one really good thing about New Yorkers is they're willing to give it a try. Mm-hmm. And that's really cool. And that for us was the thing we were the most afraid of when we started. And we had an amazing welcome from people where they were like, you know what, let's try. And that.
And then I'm sure as they taste your food, slowly you can start introducing the things that didn't do so well, because they'd be more willing to say, okay, I know I can do this. My stomach can handle it. Let me now try this other thing that that I haven't
looked
had.
Weird,
yeah, that looked
beginning.
A little weird or funny or smelled funky.
Yeah.
But I mean, to that point, can Samsung exist in a city other than New York or maybe somewhere in California? And then the same question for you, Deep D, with food to eat. Like, where people maybe aren't as exposed to foods from various cultures.
Yeah, I mean, for us, it's to take what's in the local community and bring that to light. New York is very special, and I grew up in Queens, which is one of the most diverse places in the world. We're special because we have so much of that diversity. What we want to do is slowly take that local feel and bring it to these offices, because they don't get a chance to pay attention to what's around them. And then hopefully slowly, you know, start saying, okay, now that you know what's around you, let me start bringing in some other cuisines. Like, we've started introducing North African food and West African food. So people always know Ethiopian food, and that's all they know. So we've started talking to some Nigerian vendors, and we're trying to even take New Yorkers a step ahead. So I think we can absolutely exist everywhere else. It's just one step at a time. And hopefully we grow in New York enough that we're capable of taking our company elsewhere.
Mm-hmm. And for us as well, like, we are actually in the process of franchising. And there is a lot of interest a bit everywhere around the world. And I think the latest political issues that happen around immigration were actually worked in our favor, because people became more and more aware of the footprint of those immigrants in the USA. And for us, it was actually very beneficial. Hmm. And I do feel that this happened not only in New York. This, we are talking to vendors in California. We are looking at other things in Charlotte and Chicago. And there is an interest to try a bit more.
Yeah.
I mean, I think there is that, like, food as resistance movement that's been happening, that sometimes when people feel a little powerless with what's happening with policy, they feel like, well, something very tangible I can do is go support, like, an immigrant-owned business by eating their food. I mean, that sometimes that's just, like, literally the only thing you can do immediately.
Well, that's exactly how I sell to really large corporates. Mm-hmm. A lot of times we notice that they have quotas. So we are a female-owned business, as it is my company. And a lot of times they need to support a certain amount in their quota of, you know, female-owned businesses. So we say to them, by working with Food to Eat, you are able to support X number of women-owned businesses, immigrant-owned businesses, and minority-owned businesses. And for them, it's just a win. It's a great story. Why not say that we, you know, help support hundreds of local businesses within our community? And it's not only a great story, but you're actually doing it actively by helping their bottom line. Because at the end of the day, that's what these businesses need, more business, so that they can grow and expand and start trying to, you know, open that second store. Or, you know, like, one great story is that we worked with a vendor of ours that had two storefronts, closed one of them down, and ended up opening up a commissary kitchen because she could only service 50 people from that those two locations each. And now she's able to do 500 plus, catering orders. And so we were capable of giving her enough business and keep, you know, kind of pushing her and her story and empowering them to keep thinking that they don't have to be just a small fast casual restaurant, that they can actually expand a certain other part of their business so that they can do a lot more and keep talking about themselves and talking about their stories.
And catering for us is even more fun, because at least for our food is really made for sharing. So, you know, Lebanese food is a lot about meza and, you know, small tapas style plates that you share, etc. So catering is a lot of fun for us to prepare, because this is where you can really have a lot of flavors and try a lot of things and actually mix and match. And this is where the community aspect of it is really fun.
This is wonderful to hear. We're going to take a quick break to hear from our commercial sponsor, and then we'll be back to talk more with Deep Tea and Corinne.
Thank you.
I'm Dave Arnold, the host of Cooking Issues on the Heritage Radio Network. We all know and love Chinese takeout dishes like General Tso's chicken and egg rolls, but here's the thing. Even though we call it Chinese food, it's not like the food you'd find in China. What's the story behind this cuisine, and how did it become so popular that you can find a Chinese-American restaurant in nearly every town in the country? The answers may surprise you. Visit the Museum of Food and Drink in Brooklyn and see our newest exhibition, Chow, Making the Chinese-American Restaurant. Chow engages visitors with compelling accounts of how Chinese immigrants overcame racism and created Chinese-American cuisine. Discover the science behind the flavors of your favorite takeout dishes, feast on rotating tastings developed by the country's most talented Chinese-American chefs, and try your hand at writing your own fortune, which will be baked into actual cookies by a 1,500-pound fortune cookie machine. But what better way to learn, connect, and eat? You can visit Chow at the Museum of Food and Drink on Fridays through Sundays from noon to 6. Tickets and more information can be found at mofad.org.
Hi, I'm Sam Ben Ruby, host of The Grape Nation on Heritage Radio Network. Tune in every Wednesday at 6 p.m. to hear some of the best people in wine tell you about what's going on in the world of wine. Support my show and all of Heritage Radio Network's programming. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and click on the beating heart to donate.
Hey, this is Food Without Borders. I'm in studio with Corinne Aswad and Deep Tea from Food to Eat, and we've been talking about their women-owned businesses because they are women and they own them. Corinne, what was it like living in the Middle East and being a female entrepreneur?
That's a question that I have all the time. Yep. It was actually counterintuitively really cool, because people were not expecting you to be a female entrepreneur. So you kind of stand out a bit more. Now it's no longer the case, but at least when Christine, my sister, started, she would go to a meeting and people would look for the man, the father, the brother, the husband that actually owns the business. So they were like, oh, so that's your father's company. No, your brother, still not. Your husband, So it took some time to actually become a recognized or legitimate business owner. Now she was voted best businesswoman in the Arab world. She's in the top 100 most influential Arab women. So she really made a footprint or a mark that's an important one. For me, it was weird because we didn't always have a role model to look up to. So you didn't really know how to dress, how to talk, how to behave. My mom owned her own business, but it was kind of more of the anomaly than the norm. Today, we try to give back. So we do a lot of education. We support a lot of education for women in the Middle East and around the world. And we don't see a difference anymore. Now it's no longer being a woman CEO in the Middle East. It's being a CEO in the Middle East. And I think the biggest change is the mentality when it comes to your partner. And Christine, my sister, said a sentence in a commencement speech that I love. We grow up with the idea of needing a partner, a husband, and sometimes this hinders a bit your ambitions. And she always says, if your partner does not support your dream, change your partner, not your dream. Mm. And this is, for me, the most important mindset change that we need to effect in the Middle East. It's you as a woman are powerful enough and you're capable enough and your dreams are worthy enough for them to be fought for. So
I think women everywhere, we're dealing with that issue here as well, right? I mean, there is still within the tech industry, women aren't looked at seriously. I've gotten asked, when are you going to have a baby? Which is ridiculous. First of all, it's not legal. Second of all, it's none of your concern. Third of all, it doesn't stop me from doing my day-to-day job. Like, it only makes me stronger. And as a new mother, it's almost helped me become a better entrepreneur because I know how to prioritize myself. So everything you just said applies to women everywhere. Mm-hmm. And sadly, we're all still dealing with issues, and hopefully things will change. But it comes from, you know, us taking part in and being the role models for women everywhere so that, you know, they can be what they can see.
Yes, I totally agree. And I think being a consultant, actually, I also, this resonates a lot with me. I feel that the generation before us learned to succeed as men. So they mm-hmm. kind of dressed as men and behaved as men and had the mimics, the attitude of men. We need to learn to succeed as women. So in our own way, with our own strengths and weaknesses. And this is something that we're learning. So, and for me, it's a really enjoyable journey. And I feel that there's a lot of very powerful, very aspirational women around me, and we feed off each other. And I do feel that things are changing for the best.
That's good. That's nice to hear. And then, you know, I'm also really happy to hear that you said that, you know, what's been going on with immigration policy has had a really positive impact on your business. Deepti, has that been pretty consistent with most of the businesses you work at,
yeah,
or not so much?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't heard anything, you know, negative. I think, if anything, for us as a business, because we concentrate on immigrants as a part of our storytelling process, that's only helped get our companies to start thinking more consciously about who they're giving their orders to. And they are asking, like, oh, can you tell us a little bit more? The companies that didn't care about it as much in the past, and they were just, you know, making sure that we get their food there on time and as efficiently as possible, getting everything done, they're more interested in those stories. They're more interested in our story, in my story, and wanting to understand the why of our business, and it's not just what we do. And so that's been great for us. I will say something Trump did in the last week, which hasn't been great for the tech startup industry in general, is that he is taking back the visa process for startups, startup entrepreneurs, for entrepreneurs that are starting companies in the U.S. Mm. So that, I'm sure, will start to affect the industry because, you know, I've had developers that I've hired on visas because they were just that great, you know, and they understood what I was doing and they were passionate about what I was doing. And so that will be really a shitty process that we're going to have to go through as a tech industry, but hopefully we can fight through it. A lot of tech leaders had voted that in during the Obama administration, so hopefully we can get past the shitty things that he's doing.
It's interesting, like, the day-to-day things that are not really, I mean, I didn't know that, like, how many things are just sort of slipping through the cracks and not getting reported on because there's so much.
There's
news.
So much. And, you know, one thing he's really good at is sound bites, right? Mm-hmm. He knows what people are going to pay attention to. And a lot of times that
the things he doesn't tweet about.
Yeah, exactly. You know, that's exactly what's happening. It's what him and Ivanka and Jared Kushner don't, you know, like, they're not presenting to the table. Those are the things that we don't hear about. So if you're not following, which is why it's so essential and so important for people to be more active. And you see that happening. You know, I have more friends that are saying, I want to be active. What can I do? Mm-hmm. And, you know, by helping local businesses, by helping immigrant-run businesses, these are small things that you can do. But educating yourself about what's actually happening and then proactively talking to your local congressman or councilman or, you know, assemblyman, and just understanding how you can talk to them, because they're going to understand based off of what their constituents are saying that this is what's most important for them and this is what I should be concentrating my time on. If they see that no one's calling in and no one wants us to talk about these issues, then they're going to continue on whatever's most important to them. So I think it's most important for us to educate ourselves and keep reaching out to local, you know, politicians and making sure that our voices are being heard.
Yeah, that's great advice. And it's unfortunately a great place to stop because we are out of time, although I'd love to keep talking all day. Can you both tell us where to find you in person and on the internet with your respective businesses?
Yeah, Twitter, Instagram handles are Food to Eat. Mine, Deepti Sharma, if you search me, you'll find me somehow, somewhere.
But I don't mean like where you live, but like, yeah, how to follow your business.
Yeah, follow us on Instagram and Twitter. We're always, we are actually doing a rebranding right now so that we can talk more about our vendors and share their stories. So hopefully if you follow us on Instagram, you'll hear more about the interesting people we get to work with.
We're also on Instagram, Facebook, and Twitter with the handle Semsom Eatery. So that's Semsom Eatery. We have three stores at the moment. One is Astor and Broadway, so 2 Astor Place. The second is in Columbus Circle, and the third one is 41st and Lex.
Great. Thank you both so much for joining me today. It was really a pleasure to talk to you and hear about your amazing enterprises. Check us out here next week, same time, Wednesday, 5 p.m. EST on heritageradionetwork.org.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.